evening, everyone. Here we are again. So, as you know, we're in Module 10, which is called The Development of Ego, and we're on Class 3, which is the second skanda, feeling, or feeling and attitude. So, I just wanted to give a little introduction, and then the things on the page are kind of an outline of some of the things we'll be covering tonight, and a review, actually. So, as you know, we're using this book, The Glimpses of Abhidharma, and actually, this is from a seminar on Buddhist psychology in the 70s. So it's pretty dense. I mean, even though the chapters aren't very long, I think you probably have noticed that it takes a wee bit of work to milk out the essence. And I find it really is helpful to go back and keep reading and kind of take notes and think about it. So you may ask, well, why in the world are we studying this? This is the development of ego. And the reason we're going into this particular topic is because we've talked a lot about non-self and egolessness and emptiness. So what is that? And there is a way to really go deeper into our understanding of that. So that's what we're doing here. And as I said, we try to mix it up. So we're going into the heavy stuff, and then we'll do something else next time. So we've said that ego or self-cherishing is the reason for suffering. That's the reason we experience suffering. So that's why we're working on this. There's no way to unravel this unless we go to the heart of the matter. And we can't just say, ego, be gone. It doesn't work. You can't really just make some kind of a statement and then go on and change your total view of the world. It doesn't work like that. But we have to really understand what ego is and investigate it. And then we have a better chance of actually outsmarting it, you could say. And I want you to know that as you get closer to the power of ego, there are some side effects, you could say, of going down this path. And one could be immense irritation, which is personally is coming up a lot for me. I couldn't help it. My computer just wanted to print 100 copies of this. What can I say? I just kept... Anyway, the ego is very strong. And for us to really uncover ego and see the game that's underneath, it causes reactions. So I just want you to be aware of that. Just pay attention and just keep working with your meditation practice. Really, that is the key to even understanding anything we're saying here tonight. If you don't practice, it's very hard to get any sense of what this is all about. So, actually, my friend Erica sent me a wonderful email today when I said how irritated I was. She says, ha, irritating, yes. Lots of twofold, full-blown ego reaction to this one. So that's twofold. Do you want to say what you mean by that?
Well, twofold egolessness is egolessness of self and other. And in this case, everybody's firing guns. It's my experience with this material.
Yeah.
Is that you really feel sort of disintegration of your sense of yourself, and then there's this sort of reaction in which you're really sort of doubling down and getting really a good taste of how uncomfortable you find that.
Mm-hmm. Do you mean like the ego's trying to protect itself?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes. Yes.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Don't get near me.
That's
I'm holding on. And the more you go into it and really work with uncovering it, the more you'll get this reactivity. So it's important to balance things out a little bit. So just be aware, and that's often what happens. Maybe not for everybody, but the other thing is, the more we try to figure this out, the more we can't figure it out by using our normal way and our normal concepts, and the more frustrating it gets because there's no way to understand it logically. So that's very frustrating. We just keep at it. We just keep at it, and we keep it our meditation practice. And we keep working with this also as a contemplative exercise, you could say. So this is all about this deconstruction project of taking apart ego or dismantling it by looking and seeing and penetrating it. So we're studying the mind here and how we actually build or construct the self. And one way I think of this, it's like using a microscope. When you look in a microscope, you see things that you've never seen before. So I always think about, who is it? Lewin Hoek or someone? What's her name? So from Holland, and who discovered the microscope, I think. And what it must have been like to look for the first time at a slide and sort of have this discovery of, you know, what's underneath things. And so with our mind is like the microscope, and our mind is looking at mind, you could say. But this tool we have is prajna, which is really this clear seeing or this ability to turn and look back at the mind. So we're examining now how the mind actually works. Another way to talk about this is Panlap Rinpoche always talks about Buddhism as the science of mind. So I like that expression because we think of science as about investigation, looking into things objectively, reaching conclusions based on the evidence. And in the same way, this is really investigating and looking. There's really nothing to believe in. Now, if you feel we're shoveling something towards you that you have to swallow, you need to squeak and and say, wait a minute here. And that's fine to push back, you know. And that's, I want this to be a discussion tonight. I'm not going to really say that much. But it's really about sharing our experiences and kind of going through this together and learning and kind of struggling it out, you could say. So one example, so I was thinking about science. I don't know a lot about science, but I read this great book. It's called Marie Thorpe, The Woman Who Charted the Ocean Floor, I think. And it was in the 1950s. Women weren't at all in geology, but men were off at war, and they needed somebody to fill the slots. The oil company needed people to still go out and look for oil. So they let women into the program in the 50s. So this woman studied geology, and then she got very interested in the ocean floor. And she also was very good at drawing. And they didn't let women on the boats, so she couldn't even go out and explore. I mean, you know, that's 1950. This is not long ago. So she actually got a lot of data that men would bring back, and she started mapping the floor of the ocean. And she said, the plates shift. And that's plate tectonics. And the geologists were so invested in the fact that they didn't believe that was true that there was so much resistance for a really long time. Finally, they came to say, yeah, this is only 1950s, the early 50s, that this is the way it works. The Earth is not solid and doesn't move, but actually there are plates that are moving. So when you think of that, this was revolutionary in their mind. So they had this view, And someone probably got some kind of prize for holding that view. And then along comes more data. Well, here's prajna, you could say, more tools, ability to map, and then here's the information. So now we have to change our view. So in the same way with the ego and the way we perceive our world, I'm here, my name's Emily, I have a history, this is a complete thing, I've got it together or not, but here I am, and you're there. I know each person has their own little personality and Twitters and whatever, and it's so obvious, right? There's nothing else. But what we're saying is we are mistaken. That basic belief is a mistake. Okay, so is that true or not? This is all about an investigation. You don't have to believe anything, but all you're asked to do is stay open and ask these questions for yourself. And the Buddha said, this is what I discovered 2,600 years ago now. And other teachers have presented this as well. So what we're doing is just saying, look, and we're pointing in a certain direction. We're not saying it's something to memorize or figure out or go at exactly the way we're saying it. So it's about opening and looking and letting go. And it takes time to really let this sink in. You can't just like keep pushing against the door. So you work with it and then you relax and you meditate and you let go and you just keep working at it. So last week, Michael Fagan did a great presentation on form. And the week before, Michael Levin did an introduction to the five skandhas. So this is the topic, and this is how we begin this process of unraveling. So the five skandhas, as we mentioned, that means, skandha means heap or aggregate. So these are five piles, you could say, or pieces that add up to the ego. So right there is a clue. There's nothing like one solid thing. And these are a very rapid way of solidifying our world. And this happens so fast and so habitually that we don't even see it. We don't even know we're doing it because we just do it. We don't even think about it. So what we're doing in meditation is slowing down this process and putting holes in our solidification of the way we see the world. Basically, we're turning into what's the cheese with holes? Swiss cheese. I'm not eating as much cheese, so I'm not studying the case anymore. So we're slowing down the process and looking at it step by step. So with ego, where does ego begin? And how does it build up to a full-fledged, solid ego structure? So now we're on your paper. That's where I am now. So if we look at the five skandhas, just to review what we went through before, the first one is called form in the book, The Glimpses of Abhidharma. So I've added some words here that you'll notice that may help you. If they help, good. If not, forget it. Form, duality, reification, and reification means making something a thing or solid or any other concept. Does that cover what that means, Michael?
Yeah, it's the same thing. Duality is splitting the world into self and other.
Right.
It's at any level, yeah.
And reification means the same thing?
Yeah.
Solidifying.
Making a thing.
Good thing. And the second one is feeling, and the way Michael talks about it a lot is he uses the word attitude. So we'll be talking about that tonight. That's what we're going to cover tonight. The third one is called perception, also impulse, and Andrew Holacek mentions impulse along with perception, and also prejudice. That's another way of using thinking about that. The fourth one is called intellect, and formation is kind of used more now, I think, than intellect, but that's another approach, and concept. So concept we're familiar with very much. And number five is consciousness. So each week we're going to cover one of those, and we're going to go through them. With that, Elise?
At the end, we'll have a whole big
ego. Oh, you'll have. You will have built the big ego pile. Well, that could be. No guarantees. So the first one is, the beginning is ground. And so this is a review of what Michael covered. The ground, and Trungpa Rinpoche in The Glimpses of Abhidharma talks about it as the all-pervading basic ground. And the other way we talked about that was the absolute. And we mentioned someone brought up the Lojong slogans, and we've studied that a little bit. So Lojong, the beginning slogans, are the absolute slogans. So if you go back and look at those, that may give you some more clues to what this is talking about. Rest in the nature of Alia was the one we brought out, I think, last time. So you could go back and study that. Yeah?
So I remember there were two kinds of ground. There was primordial ground.
Mm-hmm.
So are we referring to that primordial
yes.
ground?
Right.
Okay.
That's it.
Right.
So this may sound sort of unfamiliar in terms of what it means to you personally, but when you practice meditation and when you let go of thoughts, or you could say you realize that you've been thinking, and you let go and breathe out and relax into that open space, that's how we touch this. So it's not totally unfamiliar. So it's not something, you know, way out there. This is the basic ground, primordial open space. Then from that, this is explained in the book again. The energies appear out of that basic ground. And some way, Trungpa Rinpoche talks about it as sparks of duality, intensity, sharpness, flashes of wisdom and knowledge. So there's a sense that this energy arises and then it drops back down. Or you could say like waves in the ocean, they come out and then they drop back down. And from that point, then there is this blinding effect or bewilderment. And this is what is the secondary basic ground of ego. Mm-hmm. So you see, yes, go ahead.
Okay, so there's the primordial ground, mm-hmm. which is everything,
mm-hmm.
but this is the ground of ego.
Ego. Yes. Right, because
this is part of form,
right. And this sets up right away, you see duality, right, at this point. So the secondary basic ground of ego is the source of all relative concepts. So here's the distinction between absolute and relative. The eighth consciousness, and then this projection takes over. So this is the beginning of form, which is the first skanda. Yes?
When I kept saying projection, I don't have any idea what that means.
I think it's other. So this, the confusion arises because there's this energy arises, and then we solidify that. So that becomes then other out there. And that's the projection. We're basically making a big mistake here by this separation.
So is the projection sort of seeing, like looking around and saying, well, that's not me. Mm-hmm. This is me and that's the
yeah,
other.
This is me and that's
so
other.
Projection is sort of labeling other.
Mm-hmm. Do you agree with that, Michael? Or do you see something else?
Yeah. No, what we experience as appearance, we call other.
Thank you. Okay.
But that's out of the there's a sequence here, as she's noted, blinding effect and bewilderment. Mm-hmm. So that at first there's this kind of state of being completely overwhelmed. And then the next thing that happens is trying to make something out of it.
Solidify.
That, you know, somehow bouncing off. And then, you know, when something's out there, then I'm here. You know, and there's this kind of notion that this is the reality of things.
Couldn't we talk about this in terms of groundlessness?
Mm-hmm.
That in fact, what happens is we've got this the basic ground, not the absolute primordial ground, but there's a basic ground of this sort of soup of our memories and experiences and
habits.
Mm-hmm. And we're not even aware that we're like constantly bubbling in that soup
It's
a terrible image. I'm really sorry.
You're just not done cooking yet.
But I mean, so we're being pushed around in a lot of ways by things that we don't have even the slightest awareness that are motivating us or we're reacting to. And then we get free and then we solidify.
That's good.
So that's what we're talking about.
The duality doesn't take place, though, until the panic happens. Is that right? Or is it before?
Panic is first, and then the duality,
the
projection. Well, it's a pre-concept.
Yeah, it's all the
concepts start to emerge when we have duality. Yeah. Concepts need some basis for that. But first, there's panic. If there was no panic, there would be no need for the creation of duality.
Okay, so no one has any notion of what we're talking about, as far as I know. I certainly don't. But where can we get the first clue that there's something to look at? And for those of us who give meditation instruction, something very interesting happens. We give the instruction, and we always believe in having meditation instructors. This is such a useful thing. Because when we give the instruction, then we say, oh, check back in several weeks with me. And what we hear is, well, I'm not doing it right. This isn't working because now my mind is just full of thoughts. Right. Far more thoughts than before you ever gave me this instruction.
Right. Your fault.
Everyone says this.
Right.
Okay? This is the kickback everyone gives. I give it, you give it. Okay? So what is that telling us? It's telling us that until we interrupt the usual habitual self, we don't realize that we're bathing in a bubbling, continuous bath of thoughts of me and others. So this is the first hint we might get that there's even something to look at. And since we need to start with what people can experience, I think this is a good point.
Yeah, that's very
helpful. Begin.
Yeah. I just find it fascinating because my hobby outside of my work is neuroscience, neuroplasticity.
Oh, really?
And this goes right along with what we know about how we understand the world. Mm-hmm. If you read textbooks about neuroscience, this follows this 2,600-year-old list of order. Pretty darn close to what they're saying is how we have perceived the world today.
Yeah.
Does it say that we have a prejudice or attitude before we have analyzed things? Which is what this theory is saying.
I'll go back and look at it because I'm not. I believe so because they're so hardwired. Prejudice is so hardwired into us that it does pop up before we can even think about it.
Okay. So now we have the first idea about skandha. Good. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So this is the beginning of form, the first skanda. We freeze the space. Maybe I have panic and anxiety a little out of order, do you think? Is that okay?
No. Yeah,
then
no.
Panic and anxiety.
The panic
takes over.
You already said the panic earlier.
Right.
So then the freezing starts to occur.
Right.
Yeah.
freezing.
But the panic and anxiety actually become the undercurrent of the electricity that actually...
It permeates it.
Yeah, makes this whole thing buzz.
Buzz, buzz, buzz.
It's sort of continuous.
Yeah, it's continuous. Yeah. In fact, it's it feels like it's always there. Characterized, so duality begins characterized by ignorance. This is a key word. Doesn't mean you're stupid. It's you're just not noticing or paying attention or realizing. Grasping and solidification. Okay, so I'm going to read the next sentence because it's really hard to just translate it. The seventh consciousness, which is, we talked a little bit about klesha mind back a while ago during our Lojong practice. It also means the neurosis instigator, you could say. So the seventh consciousness is a way of relating the eighth consciousness, delusion or ignorance, to the six sense consciousnesses, which are touch, taste, smell, sound, sight, and mind, which is a coordinator. So this is the birth of these eight consciousnesses. Now I'm gonna say something about that. But right after that, then the next thing that happens is feeling arises. I like it, I don't like it, I'm ignoring it. And that's the second skanda. Okay, so I'm on a bike ride with Janet Bass and I'm in front of her and she's saying, why do the eight consciousnesses become the skanda of form? Aren't they about mind? I'm riding along and the wind's blowing and I can barely, you know, hear her. I have to turn around and tell her. I'm like, okay, this is an opportunity. we're out in the middle of nowhere. Alright, so...
Actually, can you say the question again?
Okay, it's on your page. Your page is there. It's in italics.
Janet is in...
Janet is now in Morocco. She'll be listening to this from Morocco probably tomorrow.
Hi, Janet.
Hi, Janet. We're still here, still struggling. Okay, so what is amazing about this is that we hear the word form and immediately we think of something. A form is a chair. A form is whatever. Are we talking about this? No. It's actually, form means the way we label what appears. So form, we take form as something solidly appearing in the world. But here form means the way we label what appears to us through our senses and mind. So something appears and we label it. So as soon as we label it, then it has all these associations with it, and we drag that out of our memory bank and all of our whatever is associated with that. And this is the duality that we set up between self and other. We establish that when we freeze the energy of the basic ground.
Emily, is that like when we're sitting here and a siren goes by? Mm-hmm. And we don't just say that's a noise, we say that's a siren.
That's the siren.
So that's form.
Yeah, right. And you then go on to the next part of it, you know, it's good or bad, or now I'm worried about whatever, or there's maybe an accident,
right.
And you've got the story going. So, yeah.
So that could be a form.
Right, because if you just heard the sound, and just, that's what we do when we work a lot, you know, we do some of those Vipassana exercises. That was trying to actually short circuit the story in between.
It's so hard because it's
so with that,
skandhas like this from like that sound to like something bad.
Something is happening. Right.
So it's like a coding.
COD.
Okay, just coding.
Oh, coating.
Yeah, coding.
COAT.
Yeah. This form is just raw sound in this case of the siren. If you think about it just as that, there's nothing to think about. It's just pure sound. And then we put something on it.
Label it, the siren.
The labeling is kind of like first we have a response before we even label it. Do we have a feeling of it being pleasurable or painful, or is it neutral? In other words, before we say anything about it, identifying it, we first have an experience.
But form is first.
Well, form.
He went through that.
Oh, he did. Oh, I see. You already said
I'm saying that the form is... We're coding the form.
The coding the form.
That's what the feeling is. We're saying,
we're laying on it.
You know, but before we say yes and no, or I like or don't like, we have to actually have a responsiveness, a kind of like a feeling.
A feeling.
A pure feeling.
Sensation.
Simply sensation or... and that sensation is already triggering some kind of yes or no. Mm-hmm.
It's almost like just walking down the street, there's this sort of sense of vigilance, sort of a panoramic kind of like assessing going on constantly.
I understand what both of you are saying. My question is, functionally, isn't that needed?
Actually, if that comes up in the material.
Basically, it's what you're saying is, to speak neuroscience, it's the amygdala. It's the oldest part of the brain.
Yeah, the little
right,
piece
which
back
is just
the amygdala gets triggered when it's something really, really
good or bad.
But amygdala is actually more about negative response, about feeling threatened when the amygdala starts cranking out.
Because it's the oldest part of the brain.
Yeah, this is more like the amygdala is triggered by the limbic system, right? Mm-hmm. The limbic system is feeling. It's simply feeling pleasure or pain or neutrality. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, this happens so suddenly. If there's like, boom, a bear coming at me, charging, bingo, yeah.
Right.
I mean, it's instantaneous that amygdala is shooting stuff out, and I got to get going,
Right.
But if we just had an appropriate response, that would not be skanda. If a truck's coming at you and you jump out of the way, that itself is not skanda.
Mm-hmm.
It's your attitude, and you better not wait for your attitude to form.
right. But we can deal with the amygdala by getting into the forebrain. The forebrain is what then goes, that siren isn't me. It doesn't affect me. That's the forebrain that jumps in and goes, it's okay, amygdala, calm down there. It's all right.
Yeah.
That's training.
You're talking now about the frontal lobes and what they do. Amygdala is central brain.
Right.
Yeah.
But in answer to your question, we have to be, there's a kind of, Michael just said basically, it isn't a matter of becoming a zombie that can't identify.
You respond to it without
personalization. Yeah, but fundamental protection mechanism, or this sort of referral mechanism back to it, that solidifies yourself.
It's very interesting because I never thought of it.
Yeah.
Those physiological responses as ego, but it must be because you get startled and you're trying to protect.
But physiological responses are really interesting subject, which perhaps at some point we won't go more into, because there's a body that isn't just all up here.
No.
Certainly.
I have an easier time with the kleshas and disassociating that, but there's some physiological responses that are very real. That's interesting to know.
Yeah. I thought, Nick, you asked, is this do we need to do this for function? And I would think we would need to do it, not just so we see the guy wanting to hit us or something, so we don't walk into a telephone pole or something, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
So when we look at the skanda process, we're never talking about making our response to the world dysfunctional.
Right. Yeah.
We're talking about a secondary effect, a hijacking of that, and talking about amygdala may not be right on that topic, because your attitudes can be like, dislike, or neutral, and the juiciest one is neutral. What we choose to ignore is the biggest. The one that's hardest to see.
So be careful about, it's really interesting to see parallels.
Yeah,
with,
it's not always.
And neuroscience, really when we actually look at the nature of mind and Buddhism, it's beyond something that can be located in neuroscience. Neuroscience is talking about the brain.
Okay.
No, neuroscience is talking about the brain.
Yeah.
It's talking about the central nervous system in the brain. when we talk about mind, we are talking about something that transcends concept. And so this, you're working with concepts. And of course, you can describe discrete factors that are going on in mental functions, but you are not describing the nature of mind. And this is a very critical distinction. Mm,
thank you. Mm-hmm.
In fact, that's what the neuroscience is never going to discover, the primordial ground. Mm. Period. Just don't even worry about it. I mean, just focus on what it does well, but it doesn't do that. And we need to understand the limitations of science, which are based on the notion that there is an objective capacity to see something, that somebody is actually recording who is objectively seeing that, which is not the case. Never has been the case. And never will be the case unless you have enlightenment operating. It's not like everybody is just this kind of neutral observer. That observer is part of the observation and is actually part of the object of observation, and it affects the field of observation.
That's good.
So be careful.
I think it's important not to get too wrapped up in making the neuroscience equal to this.
I'm not saying it's equal to it.
Or that it explains it. I think it's important to understand this for itself, and then, like, at least here. I know, the neuroscience, you buy something for $4.99 instead of $5. The $4 gets to our brain faster than the $99 does, or whatever. But that's a lot of fun, but it isn't. I think I'd like to focus on
being aware of neuroscience, I think, is enriching this.
Yeah, okay.
So I don't want to. We shouldn't be putting that down either.
Because
in many ways, in recent years, it is discovering some new things beyond.
Even more than that is, I think that since neuroscientists started working with Buddhists, Buddhist monks, they started to look at science differently. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's key, is that they're starting to recognize how much the observer impacts what's being observed. Mm-hmm. And now they're going, okay, how do we consider that? Mm-hmm. And so I really think that it is exciting to me how much looking at Buddhism can cause science to go in a completely new level.
In many ways, Buddhism is totally compatible with science, from that point of view alone, actually.
Okay, John, you had a question?
I was going to turn back to the definition of form.
All right, go ahead.
Because I understood it as maybe, I know this is sort of getting ahead of where we are, strictly speaking, but I understood concept, mental formation, as the point at which the labeling and all those accretions of sort of value accretions begin to take place. Mm-hmm. So that sounds like it's, the labeling is not form, the labeling is a concept.
Later, it's down the road.
Okay.
We're preconcepting, we're preconceptual here. We experience feelings without necessarily having concepts, even though our attitudes can shift and inform those feelings. But actually, the actual just nature of the feeling itself is before things shape up into an actual statement.
Yeah.
So that we need that fourth skanda, which is going to be all the complexities of what we call mental, dimension, the dimensions that we would call traditional dimensions of experience or mind. But before we get there, we have these other three preceding levels of occurrence.
Right, and so I get that as far as I get it. But I'm trying to get a clearer picture of what we mean when we're talking about form, because I get the sense, I like it, I don't like it. That seems fairly clear.
It hasn't even occurred yet. I mean, it's almost like, in terms of the feeling aspect of it. It's almost that there isn't an it there yet.
So when we talk about form, it's an it that isn't an it yet. I just want to make sure I understand what you said.
It's like it's easier for me to work with the sense consciousnesses because how do we contact our world?
Yeah.
There's a link, right? So that's, to me, that's the easiest way to understand form. There's a link to through sight, and there's a link, but it's still consciousness. So nothing solid out there. It's mind, and then sound, as Elise brought up, and you know there. So that's the easier way for me to get it. Yes.
I was talking to you the other day about the order of these things. To me, and this goes back to some work I did in trying to understand how people make meaning from looking at art. Mm-hmm. Perception is the first thing, not form. You have to sense it. You have to, whether it's, you're not, this is not conscious, but you walk into a room or a museum or whatever, and perceptually you're drawn to something, and immediately, then it takes form. Then you have chairness, say. I walk into this room, but I have to have eyes to know, to make me think I know that there's a chair there. So, to me, the perception has to be there first in order for form to take place. It's instantaneous. Well, it's not conscious.
Can I guess,
what I'm saying?
I think what Emily's saying is sight is there first.
Well, it depends what your perception is. It may be my ears, it may be my nose.
Or something. But something has to be there.
That's what I'm saying.
You have to have the faculty.
That happens. And then form, and it's very fast. And I get the third. What's the third one?
The third one is perception.
But
perception has a different meaning than what
perception
is.
Perception has a different meaning because the third one is also very instant. Is opinion. And you have an inbuilt opinion that's instant without even thinking you have an opinion.
Okay, let Michael talk, please.
Okay. What we're teaching purports to be a theory of cognitive and perceptual psychology, then it's wrong, and you're right. No question about it, okay? But it is not a theory of perceptual and cognitive psychology. That is why we need an explanation that is different than any explanation that a Tibetan would give to a Tibetan, for example, because they don't belong to a culture which has been bathed in psychology for a century and a half. We do. So we believe that our senses take something in, our brain organizes it, identifies the reality out there, evaluates what it is, and then we form our opinions and perhaps our prejudices and whatever, and that's the order in which things happen. That is that is the psychology.
That is Western Buddhism.
No, it is not Buddhism. It is psychology as it's been developing for, Freud, but certainly from Piaget onwards.
But in the introduction here, I mean, he does say.
I can't help it, he's a Tibetan.
One might say the study of Abhidharma is a theoretical one in some sense. This part doesn't make sense. But it also has the quality of this one, the quality of personality, individuality, because the Abhidharma is a survey of the psychology of the human mind.
So as long as you believe that's the way humans operate, you're going to say this is wrong.
No, I'm not saying it's wrong. I just think in order for me to understand it, there's just a little bit of a...
Turning it around.
Just a second. I'm going to repeat what I said because I'm not budging on this point.
Okay.
as long as you believe that this is a theory of perceptual and cognitive psychology, you will see that it's wrong. It puts it out of order, and you've already noticed it's out of order. It doesn't work. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Oh, okay. I see what you're saying. Yeah. All right.
Okay.
So it's something else.
It's
not a theory of of psychology.
And yes, of course it is.
It's Tibetan psychology.
No, it is not Tibetan psychology. It's how the mind works. So as long as
okay,
hold it. I want to finish this point.
You're sticking around.
Yeah. Okay, let's keep at it.
Yeah, as long as we believe that we examine things and then come to conclusions about them, and this doesn't make any sense at all. Until we see that we abide in a murky mess of egotistical views that totally delude us, this will not make any sense. So we have to look at how our mind bathes itself in this drunken, he refers to, what does he say?
That part you read.
Yeah, intoxicated,
that
all intoxicated.
That our mind dwells in intoxicated misperception so habitually that we regard that as normal.
Right.
So until we start to see maybe that's true, we're going to, it'll be in the wrong order. Until we see that our prejudices come before any attempt to address the world in any rational and reasonable way, those two are in conflict with each other. One, they come in a different order. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah.
Particularly since we're dealing with language. And language is always murky. And we, even the word perception.
Oh, yeah.
Or form. I mean, what the hell is happening? So that we're kind of in a double bind.
Well, actually, it's really, really much more simple. It's like you're already jumping. When you get to perception, you're already jumping. You're already assuming something. You're assuming a lot. You're operating on a whole set of assumptions. You're taking for granted, and you don't explore the very first thing, which is space. How can anything be at all? How can anything appear at all without space? So when we talk about the first gun, and we're talking about that that very, very fundamental open and an expanse that is fundamentally beyond the capacity of mind to grasp. And so now it doesn't mean that mind cannot be trained in the practice of meditation and understanding. It's understanding the nature of mind. Eventually, and this is what we're learning, is we can actually understand this properly. But our habit, and by that I don't mean just our own personal habit alone, because it's been invented for us in the culture we live in, and as human beings who share this fundamental set of problems that are basic to everybody. Hope and fear, pleasure and pain, and response to it. That we're jumping off of something else that we don't examine, and that's what the Buddha actually explored. He actually understood that if we could just drop everything, there is something more, something far simpler that we don't acknowledge. And this is the first thing to acknowledge, is the great space that is this ground. If we see that, in order to see that, we have to begin to realize what's blocking our understanding or experience of that ground. It's this constant. This is where we get into the panic and something before we've already said, or not even said, but we already even have an actual perception. The perceptions actually arise as a response to this. And they're trained because we are all trained to see things in certain ways because we share karma that we agree on to start with. That's how we even sit in the same room and talk to each other and pretend we understand each other and try to make ourselves understood.
I want to give Ed a chance.
Yeah. I'm going to steal from that great boxcar of a brain of yours. Last week you used two terms that helped me get through the next module. You talked, the term was fundamental bewilderment, and the other was bifurcated consciousness.
Boy, oh boy.
Don't ask to your head.
49 years ago, when I was up in Chestnut Hill there, I actually did a study psychology class, make-believe psychology. because it was undergraduate. And it was a book, The Concept of Mind.
Huh.
You know, it was by Gilbert Ryle, I think. And, you know, I mean, I'm sitting here, I read that book, you know, I read part of it, Bob read part of it, he read to me, I read him in the car. And, you know, I mean, it's all here tonight. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, separating and not separating the self and the non-self. But, yeah, you brought that quite a lot with those two terms that just don't make sense, but when you put them together, you say, oh, yeah.
So since it all comes together, how can we use this? I mean, it's supposed to be, this is fundamentally practical, right?
Yeah.
You have an answer?
Mary has an answer.
I was just thinking about this. Maybe
okay, go ahead.
My feeling about this is that the point of sitting, if we're going to start from a basic, the point of sitting is to relax in a spaciousness, to connect with all. And if we do that, we relax into a consciousness that is without duality. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so is that the basic point of this stuff?
Yes, mm-hmm. You got it.
Okay,
right.
So, how do we go from what we're talking about with all these, you know, lists
yes. and consciousness?
How do we make this tangible in daily life? Is it through sitting and, you know, just over time, it'll open naturally and then we'll go, aha.
Maybe.
But, yeah, the sitting is critical.
Know.
And what you described as the open space was a beautiful definition, a starting point. So you could say, why do we need all this anyway? Isn't this just more layers of stuff on top? But actually, it gives us, it's like a map. If you study a map to get to New York, you're never going to get there if you don't actually go follow it. And this gives us more, it gives us more of a picture of how our mind works. Like, we can sit and meditate and maybe figure this out, but it's quite a path, and it took the Buddha quite a long time to come to this. Even it seems sort of basic, but so we're using that knowledge that's already someone's already had gone, basically dug deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper and said, oh, I see how it's all put together and why it's all an illusion. And he looked out and said, wow, this isn't what I thought. There's a shift here totally happening. So we can't, it's very hard for us to come up with the five skandhas ourselves. I mean, to really see this sequence, because it's so fast. It's like they say, can you see your eyelid with your eye closed? Your eyeball's there, can you see your eyelid? It's so close you can't see it. It's sort of the same idea.
Can you
idea.
See your own eyes?
Can you see your own eyes, right?
But, I mean, so we actually generally wrote right on this thing we call consciousness, which is going to be where we end up, the fifth skandha. But then, when we immediately start sitting, we start experiencing other stuff.
Right.
And so that's when I go, oh my God, I'm doing nothing but thinking all the time. Because I wouldn't be able to say that if there wasn't one little squeak, just a tiny, tiny gap that a mosquito could get in there and, you know, sort of recognize, oh, that's all it's going on, it's thinking. But, you know, actually, that gap, that's why instructionally, when we're actually talking about the out-breath, coming to a point of just giving ourselves a moment of resting in that space before we start the in-breath again is an introduction to this fundamental ground. And so it's here all the time. Mm-hmm. Everything that we're going to explore here fundamentally starts to clear up when you realize it's been here all along. But because, you know, I have to undo all of my wiring that I'm traditionally, you know, utilizing, or is utilizing me, is actually more the case. I'm being simply a robot on some level that's been programmed by many different factors. And so we're actually looking into what the programming actually
is. And how is perception
programmed,
yeah. You know.
So the wiring is
right.
The form, the feeling, the perceptions, the formation, and finally the consciousness, which is seemingly as though, yeah, this is the whole thing. This is how I know everything and know what I know. And, you know, I shrug my shoulders for what I ignore because it's not important, you know.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, no, I think that was very useful. One of the great things about this book is that he brings in other sources.
The power and the pain.
Yeah. The power and the pain. For instance, if you look in chapter 14 is what begins the part I excerpted on our website. He starts by quoting Eckhart Tolle, someone else, okay? Michael put me on to what Gurdjieff has to say with different language, but it comes out to the same place. We live in this delusion in which we construct the world in a totally crazy and inconsistent way, and we can find this out. And yeah, this is not the only possible program in the world for doing that.
Mm-hmm.
It's the one we're trained in, but yeah.
It's one way.
Yeah. I take your analogy, yeah. which is there's the map,
yeah.
And there's the journey.
Yeah.
And this, all this stuff is the map.
Mm-hmm.
But don't confuse it for the journey.
Mm-hmm.
Or the territory.
The yeah. whole thing.
The
right.
territory
You're not there.
Is what we actually, when we actually determine for ourselves,
right.
through our own direct perception. That's the territory.
Right. Yeah.
We have to experience
yeah.
that insight ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So do you want to say something about feeling, or have we done it?
Well, we've been talking about feeling, I think. I okay. think... You know, it's this going, I have here going further into the dualistic split. And, you know, it's easy to think of pleasure and pain, or pleasure and, you know, positive, negative, or indifferent. And as Andrew says here, he presents that layout as the seed for passion, aggression, and ignorance, which we've all heard as those three. So that comes in the next one, as perception, impulse, and prejudice. So at this point, with feeling, it's again pre-concept. It's sort of the immediate reaction. You know, you see shit on the sidewalk. Ugh. You know, you're not going towards it. You're going back. You see, you know, whatever. You're going to go towards it, or you're going to pull back. So this is the feeling, and it's very, very basic here. Very basic. Yes?
I do have a question. Just above where it says feeling slash attitude, that paragraph, it says, remember that the first four skandhas mm-hmm. are pre-skandhas.
Pre-concept.
Getting too fast, blah, blah, blah. And it says, we freeze, we label, and then we have a feeling about it. I think of the labeling as happening, but that was like at the level of concept.
Well, it actually is,
this
but
is
when,
before,
when you're using that term label,
earlier.
It's actually a form of grasping.
Right.
And so, because that's how this whole thing starts to happen, is like trying to put things together that are not together. In other words, just flash.
You're recognizing.
Flashing coming out of the primordial ground is just continuous, it's discontinuous, and so we want, somehow, to pull those things together to make that like, you know, we want that film to be going instead of a bunch of, you know,
still
shot, because those are unsettling, because they disappear, they fly up, they flash up and they disappear, they flash up and they disappear. We want to see a continuity, you know, bing bing bing, so it just all looks seamless, when in fact that isn't the way it is. But we have to get really, really quiet to begin to see or even acknowledge that, you know, this is the case.
The space.
There are times when this can become apparent, when we don't have to be, you know, there are what we could call unusual situations or unusual circumstances where we could find this actually occurring and be able to see it and ascertain it for ourselves. I have to think about how I could share that with you, but I want to leave you with that right
okay.
now.
So I think it's time to close. And does anyone have any burning things? So take it home, work on it, think about it, do your practice, relax in space, and give this whole process a lot of space. You know, don't try to solidify it, and that's part of going through it.
This is a very good book, by the way.
Yeah, I love this book.
I was after I saw that notice on in the that you posted in the email. Then I checked on it, and I was really again impressed by the how he is able to clarify the actual workings. So, if anybody is possibly interested, I could probably order some copies.
When would you have them by?
I just want to get them by next week.
Who's the author?
Oh, that's
right. Called Power and the Pain. I think it's also in an e-book. You could get that. I'm pretty sure it's an e-book. You can
the
get
author's
it
name.
It's
the author's name is
Andrew Holacek, and we've quoted him on the website. We've downloaded three chapters. And the second one is called Frustration by Design.
There you go. How encouraging is that? Frustration.
So it's about turning that struggle into genuine joy on the path.
Yeah, I did read it. I just didn't know about it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.